Any other questions? I wanted to know, how would you compare the Japanese syntax of Shikantaza compared to its meditation?
So how to compare the Japanese and then Shikantaza with inside meditation? I haven't really done Shikantaza formally, so it's really only what I've read and spoken to with people about. And it seems very similar to me. It doesn't seem very different. I think in at least some forms of insight meditation, there's an emphasis on specificity of what it is that's arising. You know, so there's a really clear and very precise noticing moment to moment of thought, sensation, emotion, breath, you know, covering the whole range. My sense is, and again, this is not from having practiced it, but in Shikantaza there is the general awareness of all that. But I don't know if there's that same specificity of recognition. But mostly I would think they're quite similar.
When you were talking about your engagement with fear in the first half, I was thinking about hearing Genpo Roshi some time ago, deciding that what he needed to do was to concentrate on the emotion of jealousy and how he had actually sat with that, and the difficulty, you know, obviously the enormous difficulty had given him for, I think, a couple of years. I've always wondered about that as a tactic ever since, about the tactic of identifying one's major tendency and then sitting with it in that sense, almost like a bullfight, in fact, it seems to me. And I wondered if you...
Did you say almost like a bullfight?
Yeah, and I wondered if you could comment on that.
I think it's always helpful to recognize the strong patterns that are running one's life. But it goes back again to asking the question, what's the attitude in my mind about it? Is it an adversarial relationship? Is there judgment of it? Is there fear of it? Is there wanting it to go away? Or is there that real impetus to investigate and understand its causes, why it comes about, so that there's an interest in it? If there's interest, it's not a bullfight. Then it's... For myself, in my life, when I'm going through a period of some kind of suffering, having internalized to some extent the understanding that it's 100% my responsibility, at this point, suffering really piques my interest. It's like, if I'm suffering, I want to know, well, what's going on? What's happening in my mind? What's happening in the way I'm relating to it that's causing the suffering? So then it doesn't feel like a bullfight at all. It doesn't feel like a fight at all. It feels like a real inquiry into suffering and its causes and the way to the end, which, of course, are the noble truths of the Buddhist teaching. You know, when we are in a situation of some suffering, at that point, the Four Noble Truths are not Buddhist philosophy. We're in it. The suffering is there. You know? And so we can really use that as the basis for an examination of the entire path. So that's really what brings vitality to our practice. If we think of practice, meditation practice, is just about sitting on the cushion, just about going on retreat, we're missing a lot. You know, the practice is our life. And it's about seeing where is the suffering, where is the freedom, how can I understand what's going on? So there are many life situations which can be as illuminating and freeing as anything that happens on the cushion.
I have trouble developing compassion for other people, just the humans in general.
I missed the first part.
I have trouble developing compassion for people. I know it's a big part of Buddhism. One of the particular examples is I'm vegetarian and none of my friends are at all. And I see them eating meat. I think, why don't they stop eating meat? To me, it seems like they're being willfully cruel. They're enjoying it. And to me, then I have trouble developing compassion for people who seem to be desiring to be cruel. That's just one example, but I suppose.
I'll tell you a story. Just after 9/11, I was teaching a retreat. And as part of the retreat, we were doing metta meditation, loving kindness meditation. And in the teaching of it, as many of you probably know, it expands to include all beings. Well, there were quite a few people from New York on that retreat. And they said there is no way that they would be able to send loving wishes to those people who piloted the planes into the Twin Towers. You know, there was no way that they could bring themselves to do that. And when they said that, it really challenged my understanding of what loving kindness and compassion is about, because it's a totally understandable response. When reflecting on that, I really came to see that we want to take a very let's say open and creative understanding of how loving kindness and compassion is expressed. So, for example, in that situation where some beings have done such enormous harm and destruction, because there are many other examples as well, the wish that I could generate that felt very deep and genuine was, may all beings be free of hatred. May all beings be free of ill will. Now, is there anyone that we would exclude from that? Even those who cause harm. Would we exclude may you be free of hatred? No, because hatred is the very cause of the harm being done. And so, when we learn to frame the love and the compassion in appropriate terms, it really can become exclusive. And so, just in the example you gave, may you be free from cruelty, if that's how you're perceiving the situation. You know, so that's your compassionate wish. And it feels very genuine and very connected to the specifics of the situation. Because if we can't wish for all people to be free of hatred, to be free of enmity, to be free of cruelty, we can't hold that wish for all beings. We're just contributing to the problem. There's nobody that need be excluded from the embrace of that loving wish.
I wonder if there's anything in the teaching that gives the advice about how to manage feelings of regret and
how to manage
feelings of regret and guilt, especially if it's to do with somebody who's no longer alive, who can't have a dialogue anymore.
Mm-hmm. So the question was about if there's anything in the teaching about how to manage regret and guilt, especially if there's not much to do about it anymore. The beauty of many years of practice is that everything has come up. It's like one of the great things about practice is that the more one understands one's own mind, the more one understands everybody's mind. Because our minds are all basically working in the same way, although our stories are different. So, I had a big bout of guilt about something. About retreat, this incident came up. I had a lot of guilt about it. And again, it's the same attitude. After being lost in the guilt for quite a while, at a certain point, I saw how much suffering I was really suffering from. So that got my interest. I wanted, what? How am I getting caught here? What is the cause of this suffering? And as I investigated the feeling of guilt, experientially, not theoretically, I really looked to see what was going on in myself. I saw that guilt is really a trick of the ego. Mm-hmm. It's really, I'm so bad because, with an emphasis on the I. So it's all this negative self-judgment, negative self-laceration, I'm so bad. When I saw that it was a trick of the ego, I developed this little technique. Are you familiar with the Buddhist term Mara? Mara is the embodiment of illusion and ignorance. So I developed this technique of what I called wagging the finger at Mara. So every time the guilt came, Mara, I see you. And then I began to see the difference between guilt and what I call remorse, or wise remorse. Because we've all done unskillful things. Nobody goes through life not having done unwholesome actions. So we all have done things that we regret. Guilt just reinforces the ego, just reinforces the self in a negative way. Remorse is that quality, which is really a very mature quality of mind. It sees the actions we've done, we take responsibility for it, we acknowledge that was not skillful, that was not wholesome. We learn from it. We said, no, that's not something I would do again. It allows us to see the impermanence. It's not something that is fixed. Our own mind, our own process is ongoing. We can learn from it. And so it becomes much more forgiving. It's not a denial, and it's not a pretending that it didn't happen. It's just relating to it in a very different way. One is very egoful, and one is really imbued with wisdom. And so when I saw that distinction, it was tremendously freeing. Because guilt is very seductive. So that's why it takes a lot of attentiveness when it arises, because it seduces us into identifying with it. Is there anybody up there? I guess you'll just have to speak your question loud. Is there a mic up there? Great.
Hi, you were part of a group of pioneers who sort of brought the teachings across traditions, if you like, the different Buddhist traditions from Asia into the West. And as now, sort of, we're seeing the first sort of couple of generations of truly native Western practice. I'm just interested, from your perspective in this sort of transitional liminal period, what do you see as the most exciting trends, and also what do you see sort of as the risks as we develop our unique Western form?
I think the great possibilities is that traditions that have not interacted or spoken with one another for thousands of years are now actually meeting and talking. Because in Asia, there's not the opportunity, really. The Japanese Buddhists had no understanding, no contact with Thai Buddhism, or Burmese, or Tibetans. So there's a lot of cultural separation. In the West, there's this tremendous funneling in all the traditions, and the teachers are meeting and speaking with one another. Many students practice in different traditions and are learning from different ways. So there's a tremendous vitality that goes back perhaps to the time of the 7th or 8th century in India, at Nalanda University, which was this great Buddhist learning center, you know, of ancient India, with tens of thousands of monks from all traditions. And so it's a tremendously vital time. Something of the same thing is happening now, which I think is great. The danger is that people get really confused, you know, because one tradition, one teacher says one thing, another teacher tradition says another thing. Often they're in conflict. And so if people are, you know, doing a little of this and a little of that, and are not really grounded well in one tradition before they open to other teachings, it could well be confusing. So that's a danger. Even for experienced practitioners, and this was very much part of my own process, I had been very immersed in insight meditation of the Burmese variety for 20, 25 years. Really, that's what I did. After that time, after about 20, 25 years, a friend of mine brought me to meet some of his Tibetan teachers in Nepal, you know, great Tibetan masters. And the metaphysics was really completely different. You know, the description of the highest reality, freedom, kind of opposite descriptions. In one description, it talked of freedom transcending even awareness. That awareness itself is conditioned, and that freedom transcends even that. The other tradition said, pure awareness is freedom. So I heard these two things. Here's something that, you know, I've devoted my life to trying to understand and express my highest value and aspiration. I really did not have a hold that difference of you, because I had tremendous respect for both teachings and, you know, the mastery of the teachers. So this was a real koan for me. I struggled with this a lot. And it was out of that struggle that one of my recent books, One Dharma, emerged. It was the resolution of that question. And what finally brought it together for me were two, you could say, insights or ways of understanding. One was the understanding that all the teachings can be understood not as statements of ultimate truth, but as skillful means for liberating the heart. Because if we take the statement, we take the teachings as statements of ultimate truth, it's like this. No, it's like this. And they're saying different things, conflict is inevitable. But if we take all the teachings as skillful means for freeing the heart from grasping, from clinging, from attachment, then it doesn't matter. It's expressed this way. Does it work to free the heart? Does this work to free the heart? They can be saying opposite things and yet accomplish the same pragmatic result. So that was very freeing to realize that. So then just hear the different expressions, the different words, but not make it into a metaphysics. So that was one very important shift of how I was hearing the teachings. The second was a mantra that emerged in my mind about the nature of ultimate freedom. I call it ultimate freedom, complete enlightenment. The mantra that emerged was, who knows? It's like, I'm not there yet. All of these people say this, other people say that, who knows? But what was interesting is that the who knows wasn't a who knows of confusion.
It was just a who knows of openness. It's like not drawing conclusions.
To take the teachings in a very pragmatic way to see if they help free the mind from grasping, to proceed along the path. Someday we'll know. And so all that, that made this, you know, tremendous wealth and variety of teachings very accessible and rich for me. So it really, there is a potential there, you know, of great benefit, but there's also a potential for conflict and confusion if we don't hold it in the right way.
I would like, if I may, to refer to what you have mentioned several times about us being 100% responsible for what happens to us.
Not what happens to us, but from how we feel. For our own internal suffering. No, what happens to us, lots of things contribute to what happens to us.
So if I go on from that, I don't understand how that can apply to people who have been, you said earlier that there were many examples that people present to you, how that can apply to people who have been injured in war, or people who are abused and treated unkindly. And one of the enormous difficulties that I experience is that there is that huge voice that's saying you are responsible for how you react. And if I'm not very careful, and usually I fail at this, I either get angry at that principle, or else it's I beat myself up for being oversensitive or angry, or stuff like that. And I can't, I don't know how to shift from that, because my bottom line, truthfully, is that I am outraged at that statement, and I can't get around that.
No, that's a really important question, because it's not an uncommon feeling. You know, I think to a large extent, at one time or another, we've all felt exactly that way. So it's very understandable. I'll just talk of it from a few different angles. Just to clear any possible misunderstanding, to say that we're responsible for our own reactions is not to say, first, it's not to condone harmful actions, and it's not to say that we shouldn't respond. And that we can take very strong, effective action. There is a suggestion that strong, effective action can come from different motivations. That usually in commonly understood, we rely on anger, the strength of it. There's a strong energy. You know, there's a power. There's a power in anger. And usually we rely on that power to right injustice. Right? Because we feel that's the only thing that's going to be strong enough or powerful enough to create an effective response. What we have seen through some particularly outstanding examples, that there are possibilities, there is a potential for other motivations to fuel a very strong and energetic response. So just to give you a few examples. I mean, you know, we all know of this. know, back during the civil rights movement in the States, Martin Luther King Jr. In seeing some of the films and of his marches in both the North and the South, what was so amazing was he was walking his marches. You have to remember the violence of the history of racism in the States. Huge, huge amount of violence. So you'll be seeing these films of him leading these marches with people on all sides filled with hatred. You could see that hatred being directed at him. And what was so astounding and inspiring and ultimately transforming of the nation was his ability to hold a loving space in the face of that violence, in the face of that hatred. Obama is president now because of some shifts that took place, and many other reasons, of course, but the power of that kind of response. We can respond from a place other than anger, other than hatred, and still respond, not pull back, not condone, not be indifferent, not be apathetic. But what's the motivation that our action is coming from? So that's one piece of it. The second piece is that most of us are not Martin Luther King, or Mother Teresa, or Gandhi, or Nelson Mandela. We have a long way to go. And so it's to really learn to be accepting of just where we are, seeing all our own perhaps less pure motives arise, the anger arise, the hatred arise, because they are. These unwholesome feelings are going to appear in us. Again, how do we see them? How do we hold them? Do we deny that they're there? Do we pretend they're not there? Do we get seduced by them? Or can we see, yeah, I'm feeling a lot of hatred now. Can you be mindful of that? And perhaps out of that mindfulness, allow it to be there without acting on it. So the force of it is there, that initial response is there, you see it, you acknowledge it, and maybe let that go, and then see, well, is there another place within me out of which I can take strong action? For years, I taught retreats for environmental activists, people who were in the front lines of social action, you know, battling the big battles with forces that were doing a lot of harm, you know, on many levels. First, it wasn't an easy crowd to teach a retreat to. Because basically they thought sitting and meditating. But those who were willing to come, and over the course of time, and the reason they came was that at a certain point, they realized the anger that was fueling their really good work was not sustainable. And they were getting really burned out. And this is a common problem with people involved in social action of one kind or another, is burnout. Why do we burn out? Because the energies that are being used in the work, if they're not wholesome energies, only sustain us for a certain period of time. And then they literally burn us out. So there are many reasons for looking to see are certain shifts possible in terms of what motivates us. But it's to be very honest about where we are, about all these different feelings that are going to come, and simply learn, we can see it, we can acknowledge it, hopefully learn to let them come and go, and find some different avenue or energy of action.
Joseph, I was interested in what you had to say about Goenkaji and your observation that it's necessary that some temperaments to be loyal, permanent state within a particular tradition, whereas some people, some temperaments can be more broad or outside tradition. That is very interesting. I wonder, do you think, regardless of temperament, is it necessary? What to what extent do you think it's necessary for an individual to stay loyal to a particular tradition, to as a student and disciple relationship? Is it necessary or not?
Is it necessary?
Is it necessary to have that loyalty or ability? I say part of the personal interest of being a member of the Western Buddhist Order. We're having this quite vigorous discussion at the moment in our own tradition about this, about loyalty or not to the teacher. I just wondered if you had any comment about it.
Well, I think it's
a
fun one question you didn't ask, maybe partly to what you did ask. I think it's really helpful to stay within a tradition and a teaching to a certain level of depth, as I mentioned before, so that we're really well grounded in an understanding of the Dharma, you know, what creates suffering and what frees us from suffering. And if we go jumping around in the beginning to a lot of different things, it can be confusing. We may not actually, you know, reach a depth in any of them. But once we have attained some genuine level of understanding where we feel that we're not confused about the Dharma, then for me personally, and other people obviously will have other views, but for me personally, the loyalty is to the Dharma. No. That's what we take refuge in. We take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, you know, and the center of it all is the Dharma, the truth, what's true. And there are many, many methods and ways and I would just shift, I think, the word loyalty to that respect, because I mean, loyalty may imply that, yes, once you're with one tradition, you never leave it. Whereas respect for a tradition, I've studied with many teachers in many different traditions, and I have equal respect for all of them. So they've all become part of my ongoing practice. And it doesn't feel disloyal at all. It just feels like there's this tremendous beauty of the Dharma, the richness of the Dharma, which is being explored. But that's my two cents. You know, other people might well have other views. One last comment. One of the things I've noticed, even as I've studied with different teachers, different methods, sometimes I find myself going back to an earlier one. So it's not, it just depends on what's particularly helpful at any particular time. The Buddhist teaching is like a vast mandala, you know, of offerings. And at different times, different approaches are helpful. So even if one has left one particular way, often we cycle back to it at a different time.
I was wondering if you could say something about a suggestion of what we can do for ourselves when we get caught, despite our best intentions and our practice and time on the cushion, in real life situations where we know that the skillful thing would be to do something else or to react in a different way. But you're emotionally caught and you're in a situation where maybe you are interacting with other people, there is no place to kind of stop and say, hold on a minute, I have to collect myself. Or is there? But can you say something to how we behave in the real world in a moment where we know we're caught and we've lost our own intention?
Of things. One is I wouldn't have a preconception of what's possible and impossible to do in the heat of the situation. Because maybe it would be possible to say, whoa, time out. Even if it's not what's usually done, I would try it. See what happens if you do that. And that's by way of saying, I would really look at the situation creatively, you know, with a very open, sense of open possibility. Could I try this? Could I try this? Could I try this? You know, and just be creative and try it. Some may work, some may not work. That having been said, there's one teaching of the Buddha which is extremely counterintuitive. And that is that it's better to do an unskillful act knowing it's unskillful than not knowing it's unskillful. You know, so when I first heard that, I mean, that just went against my total intuition. You know, if you don't know it's bad, how can you be held responsible? you don't know it's bad. But the Buddha's saying, the not knowing is just compounding ignorance on top of the unskillfulness, and that very ignorance prevents the potential for refraining from it at some time in the future. So when we're involved in some unskillful response where, for whatever reason, we're just caught by it, and we're doing it, what I would do is focus the mind on the wisdom piece that knows it's unskillful, even as you're doing it. Because then you're strengthening the wisdom in your mind. It's not quite strong enough to stop you from doing it, but you're watering those seeds. If you just are totally lost in the unskillful and are not reflecting on the fact that it's unwholesome, then you're really strengthening the unwholesome. So there is something to do right in the midst of it. Of course, just one little caution. You don't want to get into the pattern of, you know, doing these unskillful acts. Oh, well, I know it's unskillful. You know, just make watch all of that slide.
That last discussion has brought up in my mind the fact that I've been knowingly taking the life of flies recently. Because living in the country and in the hot weather, and I'm taking their life, but I really can't stand the fact that they're unhygienic, and they're around me in the kitchen when I'm cooking with food, and I try not to, but sometimes when I literally had dozens. And yes, I was really disappointed to realize on one retreat that even killing a fly is regarded as taking life and unskillable. But I still, knowing that, I still have mm-hmm. conflict.
Have you tried a butterfly net? I found that suggest is that you consider are there other possible ways. You know, sometimes we give it a moment's thought, but we don't really give it a lot of thought to see, okay, is there some possible way of removing them without killing? It does bring up, though, some very interesting ethical questions. I mean, I think that problem might be solvable. But there are other situations, real ethical situations, that are very interesting. You know, do you not kill malaria-carrying mosquitoes? You know, or termites are eating up your house. You just say, bon appetit. You know, there are some real life situations that really push one to the edge, and it may be that in certain situations when you weigh all the factors, you feel, well, that just feels the most appropriate thing to do, even though it's unskillful in terms of the taking of life. I would just be very cautious about doing that lightly and really seeing what the motivation is in the mind and seeing if it's possible to do things with as much understanding and compassion as possible. Mm-hmm. So it's just not to do it in a rote way and to explore other possibilities. But sometimes, especially living as lay people, living in the world, situations will arise. I mean, we just need to take a lot of care and be very thoughtful with it.
That brings me to the issue of metta and extending it to other beings other than human beings. Do we really want to wish peace and equanimity on a line? Wouldn't we wipe out his business plan?
I missed the last part.
Wouldn't we wipe out the line's business plan when we wish peace and harmony on the lion's species?
Yeah. It does get complicated. You know, what's good for the lion is not so good for the antelope. So I think there needs to be the recognition just of the realities of nature. But we can hold the aspiration, and maybe the aspiration, you know, within a Buddhist context, of course, can be very enlarged over lifetimes. It's a very big, the Buddhist picture is a very big picture. You know, lifetimes and different planes of existence, world systems, but really big. Maybe in that situation we really have to hold the aspiration for the evolution of all beings to a place where they can be free of aggression. And so it's always finding the appropriate context for those wishes. But I think there always is one.
From the first life on Earth, it seems that all life has lived on life. And that first bacteria is following another bacteria. But you're positive, it's really a completely other world here. I think the evolutionary instincts, for instance, some of the Buddhist teachings are around looking at not self, for instance, is counterintuitive. Much of life on Earth has instincts about survival, fight and flight. And perhaps some of our instincts are based around that. So it's deeply counterintuitive, what the Buddhist teaching.
That's true. The Buddha described his teachings as swimming upstream, right? Because it is against conventional understanding. It's against the stream of our habitual conditioning. So when we look, we don't look to the natural world as the model for what's possible. Rather, we look to the natural world to see how it's working. And the genius of the Buddha was in terms of his examining the nature of this mind and body, which by extension, you know, can be applied to all living beings. Basically, he understood those forces in the mind which create suffering, and those forces in the mind which free us from suffering. Those forces are there, and the tendencies of greed and hatred, delusion and fear and aggression, they are all there in the natural world, and they're there in ourselves. But he also saw that there are forces in the mind which actually free us from identification with what is unwholesome. It's not easy. But he showed you, you could think of it in terms of, he showed a, I'm not quite sure the right word here, the spiritual evolutionary potential. He said that there is a potential for evolving the way we are in the world. But it's not to deny that in the natural world, all those forces you mentioned are very much present. We simply don't need to remain, especially with this rare and precious gift of a human birth, we don't need to be continually enslaved by them. And that's what the Buddha was offering. That there's a way out of that conditioning. And he said that for the lion, in the lion's existence, there probably isn't a way out. And that's why he gave so much emphasis to the reflection on the very precious opportunity we have as human beings. You know, because we do have that potential. And there are many beings throughout history and in the present day who have demonstrated that possibility. You know, so it's not theoretical, it's not just some idea. People actually have done this training and have accomplished it.
I'm not sure to put the question exactly, but when I am around people that suffer or have emotional feelings expressing or impatient, I personally, when it happens to a lot of people, pick it up in myself. And then at that moment, I'm not sure, is it my own impatient or my own memory of an emotion, or is it that I'm projecting, or am I picking up
something outside myself? Yeah. In one way, it doesn't matter. Because the real question is, how are you relating to the fact that it has arisen? Things arise from many different causes. And sometimes we know the causes, often we don't know the causes. What's more important is, as these feelings arise, are we relating to them with awareness, with mindfulness, with non-identification, you know, without creating an ego self in them. From that place of balance, with where there's just open, oh, this has arisen, and we're not sure of the causes, but we know that we're feeling it. From that place of balance and awareness, it becomes easier to be sensitive to our immediate environment and to begin to intuit, oh, is there something really going on in another person? Or not? Because we're not so reactive to our own inner state. There's more spaciousness there. So it allows this greater sensitivity to begin to assess, okay, there's something going on that I'm really picking up. Well, not. But your assessment may not always be perfect. I remember on one retreat, because we project a lot. We live to a large extent in the world of our own mental projections, you know, of people. I was on one retreat, and I was being, just, it was a very calm retreat, and my mind was very peaceful. I was just doing walking meditation, and I was just in this very nice place. And at the end of the retreat, somebody else came up to me, another meditator, and said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, that's such a difficult retreat. You look so, like you were suffering so much." I should look at him. You know, because people project. And we don't always know what actually is going on in another person. That's why as a general rule in life, this is Goldstein advice, not Buddhist advice. I think it's always safe not to assume we know what somebody else is doing, but to ask them. It seems like a much more soundly based approach. Can we do one last question?
I'm not exactly sure how to phrase this question, but in the examples of a couple of the stories you've given, it's been absolutely implicit that until you got to the point of Shivam, I get this, that you've had to go into and have and hold experiences and emotions. And it seems that within the practice there's a tension between having the authenticity of the feelings you're having and yet wanting them to be, at the same time, this marvelous, spacious, released state. And there's a tension between process and goals. And there's almost a sort of tyrannical perfectionism about the goal of not thinking or behaving in a defilement or in ways defiling or unwholesome. So I guess I'm saying, it's implicit in your own stories that you have to go into the authentic, be it anger or fear or envy or jealousy, and really have it in order to have any hope of getting to a more spacious place with it. And I just feel the tension between having the process really and getting to a place that is in some way desirable. Can you talk a little bit about that? Does that make sense?
That makes sense. I wouldn't assume that it happens any one way, because sometimes it is a process, and sometimes you really need to get in there with whatever the emotion is, then work it, you know, and try to really understand it. But at other times, that might not be necessary. At other times, it could be a moment's recognition that this is just the mind state. No matter how complex or how deeply rooted, the conditions might be right at any particular moment. This is just a mind state. It comes and goes. And it might not require any process at all. So I wouldn't assume from either side that there's one way or another that it has to happen. It happens in many ways. And that's certainly been my experience. The comment was, expecting an outcome can distract you from what's really going on. Don't expect outcomes. just as a kind of maybe a closing comment. To that. a huge confusion in practice and a wonderful clarification is understanding the difference between expectation and aspiration. These are two very different mindsets. And expectation is wanting a particular result now. And aspiration is having a vision of what's possible. It's our aspirations that bring us to the path. There can be a goal, an aspiration of freedom, of liberation, of compassion, whatever, however we express it. And that aspiration can fuel us. That's very different. It's a different quality in the heart and mind than an expectation, I want it this way now. And so I would just really learn to distinguish those two and draw strength from the aspiration, which keeps you in the right direction, and practice, and it takes practice of letting go of the expectation, because things are not in our control. There are so many forces at work. Things will unfold as they do. So that distinction has been very helpful for me. So, thank you very much. Just before Paul makes a few comments, I'd like to express my appreciation to London Insight. It may seem that these kind of events just seem to happen so easily and naturally, but I know a huge amount of work goes into putting these together, and so I'm very grateful to London Insight and all the volunteers who really put energy into making this happen, and all the other programs. It's a great thing that London Insight is doing, which the public safety works about, and the presence of Gaia House for those of you who know them in Devon at the retreat center. And if you ever find yourself in the States, it'd be wonderful to see you at IMS.
Thank you very much, Joseph, for it's been a wonderful afternoon, and it's been so quickly. Just wanted to express heartfelt gratitude for your wonderful teaching and the simplicity and clarity and precision of what you had to say. It's been great. And I'm sure everyone else here has really appreciated you being in London, so thank you very much.